You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
March can be won, many stones can form an arch, singly done, and by union what we will can be accomplished still, drops of water turn a mill, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by IUPAT, District Council 3, and Pipefitters Local 533. The International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 3, fighting for working families since 1916. And Pipefitters Local 533, being the best in the industry, is earned. Our craftsmanship, brotherhood, training, and job safety make the difference. Building and buying union create better wages and living standards for all working families. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, we recognize and honor the life of Bill Onash, who died last year. Son of a KC meatpacking worker, Bill cut his teeth on radical unionism and grew up to be a member, leader, and organizer in several unions. He worked tirelessly to grow a labor party in the U.S. His writings circulated widely. Bill was a genuine working-class intellectual. In the news, Teamsters Union denounces Canadian trucker border blockade, and at last, the U.S. Senate passes a pro-worker bill. Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Michael Amish. He'll talk about the joint employer theory just in time for KC Google Workers organizing campaign. And now for the news. Now for the news from our side. February 17, 2022. The Immigration Impact website reports that a skyrocketing number of migrant teens from Central America are entering the undocumented workforce in the U.S., doing rigorous, grueling work often meant for adults, like operating heavy machinery in food processing plants. Exploitation by unscrupulous employers and a lack of follow-up by U.S. authorities mean many get trapped in this vast network of under-the-table labor. Rather than attending school, these unaccompanied minors, mostly from Central America, are filling a workforce which, before Trump, was staffed by adult immigrants. Since adults have been turned back into Mexico and are in short supply, low-wage employers have turned to teens who have families back home in need of support and debts to the smugglers who guided them to the border to pay. Under the Trump administration, nearly 16,000 unaccompanied minors, most from Central America, were expelled. But starting in February 2021, the Biden administration began admitting unaccompanied children, and a reported 122,000 entered the U.S. in fiscal year 2021. They're supposed to be placed with family and go to school, but an alarming number of teens are ending up in the hands of staffing agencies, ready and waiting to give vulnerable teens phony papers and place them in southern chicken plants and in farm work and other less regulated types of work where they earn substandard wages, work excessively long hours, and in bad conditions, but don't have the power to complain. The Labor Beacon reports that Elise Martini, business manager of the Greater Kansas City Building Trades Unions, received national recognition as the recipient of the Tradeswomen Hero Award. The award highlights the tremendous women workers within the affiliated North American Building Trades Unions. Elise is a member of the Operative Plasterers and Cement Masons Local 518 Union for over 40 years, and has been a steadfast mentor of women in the trades as well as a very active labor leader in Kansas City. Congratulations, Elise. PRI reports Teamsters leaders on both sides of the U.S.-Canada border denounced the renegade non-union Canadian truckers, right-wing marshaled foes of Canada's anti-coronavirus vaccine and mask mandates, whose blockade halted cross-border traffic for weeks, and whose trucks tied up Canada's capital city, Ottawa. The border blockade ended on February 14th after 17 days. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau invoked the nation's Emergencies Act, the first time it had been used in 50 years, and sent in forces to clear it, especially from the Ambassador Bridge connecting Windsor, Ontario to Detroit. Both the U.S. and Canada bar unvaccinated truckers from crossing. The truckers, marshaled and funded by extreme right-wingers in both nations, blocked the bridge between Detroit and Windsor and disrupted traffic with constantly honking horns. That bridge is the most heavily used U.S.-Canada crossing, with much of its traffic in trucks and transporters carrying cars and parts between plants of the Detroit Three automakers. Truckers also occupied government buildings and parks in Ottawa and blockaded a smaller U.S.-Canada entry in the northern Great Plains. But when Trudeau sent in forces to disperse them from border crossings, almost all truckers peacefully left. There were 11 arrests. The truckers' blockade forced halts in the automakers' assembly lines, idling thousands of workers, especially at Detroit's three auto plants and as far away as Alabama. The truckers' blockade forced halts in the automakers' assembly lines, idling thousands of workers, especially at Detroit's three auto plants and plants as far away as Alabama. Teamsters International President James P. Hoffa and Teamsters Canada President Francois Laporte, a vice president of the International Union, had strong criticism for the trucker protest. Laporte said, "Teamsters Canada has 55,000 truckers. The so-called freedom convoy and the despicable display of hate led by the political right and shamefully encouraged by elected Conservative Party politicians does not reflect the values of Teamsters Canada, nor the vast majority of our members, and in fact has served to delegitimize the real concerns of most truck drivers today. We firmly believe in the right to protest government policies and voice a wide array of opinions, but what is happening in Ottawa has done more harm to Teamsters members, be they truck drivers who are trying to deliver their loads, or hotel, restaurant, and healthcare workers who were intimidated, abused, or prevented from accessing their workplaces by several protesters." He said the real challenge for Trudeau's government, the truckers, and the employers is to address supply chain challenges and keep the Canadian economy going.
The gridlock on passing any bills in Congress beneficial to workers was broken last week when the Senate passed a teensy one called the Ending Forced Arbitration of Sexual Assault and Sexual Harassment Act. It's on the way to President Biden's desk for signature. Economic Policy Institute senior fellow Terry Gerstein celebrated in an NBC News op-ed saying, "The passage of this bill is a tremendous victory for workers and for justice, but it's not the end of the battle. The bill prohibits employers from forcing their employees to go through arbitration instead of accessing the courts to settle cases of workplace sexual harassment or a sexual assault. But what about the other forms of worker rights violations? Gerstein says workers need to be able to access the courts whenever their rights are violated, noting that workers are vulnerable to all kinds of mistreatment, from dangerous working conditions to wage theft to racial discrimination. Increasingly common, forced arbitration clauses for non-union workers limit their rights to use the courts to seek justice for violations of the law, including racial harassment, disability discrimination, wage theft, and other ways employers try to get around the law. The news tonight was read by Judy Ansel and myself, Chris Mann.
Listen up, we've got a war zone here today, right in our heartland. And across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they've declared a war on us, fight back, it's up to you. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers, and it's time we started calling the shots. To work could be the death of you and me, but we're not unarmed. Our weapon solidarity, Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood, the list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers, and it's time we started calling the shots. When they boost your copay,
war on the workers.
Don't you know what to say?
War on the workers.
When they talk privatization,
war on the workers.
And cooperation,
war on the workers.
When they call you a team,
war on the workers.
You better learn how to scream.
War on the workers.
Hello, my name is Tony Saper, and I'll be moderating this evening. William Wayne O'Nash was an ordinary man. He grew up in a working-class neighborhood in Kansas City. His middle name was even inspired by a local radio disc jockey. But Bill's lifelong commitment and leadership to the working class, which encompasses virtually all of us, some say 98%, maybe more, was what made his life extraordinary. Bill's commitment, yes, that's the right word, commitment to Marxism of the Trotskyist stripe, always guided his thoughts and work. He truly believed that those who did the things that made life and the economy function, whether they labored in a factory, on the shop floor, provided transportation for goods and people, coordinated those actions in a back office, fed, clothed, and healed those who did those things, they should be the ones who control the economy and politics of the world. That means essentially every one of us, all except those who claim to own it all. He tried throughout his life to do his bit to achieve just that. We're going to learn a little bit of the life from those who knew him and worked with him. We will cover his life in three parts: Bill and the labor movement, Bill and the Labor Party, and Bill and the Marxist movement. I knew Bill for some 55 years. I wish I could have known him longer. Now for part one, Bill and the Labor Movement, with Javier Perez, International Vice President of the Amalgamated Transit Union. Javier?
Thank you, Judy, and thank you, Tony, and everybody participating tonight for the opportunity to participate in this tribute to a great labor leader in his own right, Bill O. Nash. I was president of Local 1287 in Kansas City, Missouri. I had the privilege of being president at a time when Bill O. Nash and, quite frankly, Tony Saper was actually members of our union. Bill was, when I first met Bill, he's kind of different. I could tell that he was a leftist. He was very intellectual and stimulating to speak with, quiet when it needed to be. He had discernment, and he spoke up when also that needed to be, and he prodded from behind the scenes. Some of my favorite memories are, Bill, I know that we went 4.5 years without a contract. We was trying to convince the ATA at the time to do right by us in terms of health care. Instead of paying 10% more each year when health care was going up more than double digits, we wanted to pay a reasonable percentage. We also wanted to revamp our pension plan. And it was because of people like Bill, Tony, and others that we were able to endure and, quite frankly, thrive in a 4.5 year fight without a contract. We were able to endure and thrive. And that's because Bill was working behind the scenes, talking to people, explaining what belonging to a union meant and what it is and why the fight was worth it. 2 years into that fight, the company conceded on our point about the pension, so we were able to increase the pension. At the end of that fight, we actually won our issue on health care. But all along the way, there were different actions. There were rallies and different events. I remember one time the general manager of the ATA came out to addressed a group of us who were protesting outside his office. He was thoroughly pissed and embarrassed. When he got up to speak, Bill, who was our spokesperson for the union for the day, cut him off and said, "I've heard it all before. I want to know when you're going to fix the problems that we have, you know." And he stalked out of the room, the general manager, and he was incensed, and he went and hit his tail. And it was actions like that. The company used to have an employee appreciation dinner where hundreds of people would attend with their spouses. It was an event to behold. Well, due to Bill's participation and actions, the year that we decided to boycott the dinner, we only had 25 people show up for the dinner. They had to keep downsizing the room. It sent a message to the general manager and the board of commissioners. I know another time that Bill stood up at the union meeting, and I didn't know quite where he was going. He said, you know, he raised his hand, he stood up, and he was very polite. He addressed me, and he says, "The seats on this bus are terrible, and I'd like to know what you're going to do about it." And I looked at Bill, and I'd had some labor education and training, and said, "Bill, what I'm going to do is I'm going to work with you and anybody else who will work to fix that." So Bill, with six other people, formed the labor side of a labor management committee, but we didn't want it to be just any labor management committee in name, or quite frankly, the union gets co-opted and things don't get done. We were able to, with minimal lost time, quite frankly, with six people, including and add Bill for a seventh, we were able to interview every bus operator as they pulled out of the garage, the condition of their bus seats. We were able to document that. We were able to meet with our maintenance people who worked in the upholstery shop, and we were able to document that the company was not fixing the seats, even though the equipment and materials to fix the seats were there. Well, shortly thereafter, because we got the directors from each department in and laid out the evidence, they had to fix the seats. They couldn't just put it off anymore. And why they would never do it, I don't know. It just didn't make any sense. But we got it done. And quite frankly, although that took maybe a month and a half, over that next year, because one of the things I said, look, we have union meetings, and it's not just at the meetings at the hall. Union meetings when we're talking one-on-one with our members and coworkers and our friends in the workplace. You know, you may hate the union, you may think you do, but you don't want to put your ass in the seat where the springs are coming out, do you? And so, quite frankly, over a period of the next year, our union meeting attendance, because of actions like that, increased 65%. But also the danger in that for a union leader who's not really well prepared for it is that the members don't want to just come and hear about the finances and bitch about a grievance. They want to know what they can do to have fun and start stuff out there about new things. And so we just, I owe and our local union owes a debt of gratitude, Bill, to Bill and Tony and others, because our pension had not been significantly increased in 30 years. We doubled it because Bill was able to hold the people together. You know, our health care was was a joke to laugh at. Now they have meaningful health care there. So that's how I remember Bill. The other part of Bill is, has always been just a prolific writer. He has a way with words. He knows how to turn a phrase. And so he wrote regularly for our newsletter, created interest in the newsletter and other bulletins. And he really was, I wish I'd had 100 more like him, but he really turned our union, our local union around. Any success that I've had at the local union's international level was because of the foundation that Bill, Tony, and others helped me, help us build. And so thank you again for the opportunity to participate. Thank you, Mary and others, for loaning Bill for us for as long as you would, because I know it takes time away from home, but it's a work that he loved, and you loved him, and so did we. Thank you.
Thank you, Javier. Now we will have the next speaker, who will be Judy Ansel. She'll be talking about Bill's part in the Kansas City Labor Tour. Judy Ansel's a labor educator, an activist, and one of the founders of the Heartland Labor Forum. And she'll tell us how she and Bill carried out that tour. Judy?
Thank you, Tony. We lost Bill, and that's a big loss for Kansas City labor. I think Javier really hit it on the nail on the head about Bill and his activism. I got to know Bill when we recruited him as one of the worker researchers for the Kansas City Labor History Tour in 1991 and 92. This was a collaboration between labor historians and workers. Bill helped us get a bus and driver donated for the days of the tour, and we toured 10 sites significant to Kansas City labor history, including Coates House, where the Great Railway Strike of 1886 was settled, City Market, where the industrial workers of the world staged their two free speech fights in 1911 and 1914, the Musicians Local 627, now the Mutual Musicians Foundation, and the Ford Winchester plant, where the first sit-down strike in the Ford system occurred in 1937. Bill took on two assignments. True to his origins with a father who was a strong unionist in the United Packing House Workers Union, Bill wanted to research the history of organizing packing house workers in Kansas City. I remember wandering around the West Bottoms with Bill, looking for a site we could use to stop the bus and tell the story. We searched and searched, but there were no old packing houses still standing. Both of us were very sad that Kansas City didn't think to preserve the history of the industry that made us a cow town and affected the lives of so many of its working class members, both black and white. We settled on having the bus stop at the Livestock Exchange, which Bill pointed out was where the bosses worked. There, Bill told us the extraordinary story of the organizing at Armour Meatpacking, where workers were native-born whites, Croatian immigrants, and blacks primarily. They built the first truly integrated and militant union in Kansas City. It was an inspiring story, and you could see Bill's pride in his roots. The other assignment Bill took on was to tell the story of the Kansas City General Strike of 1918. It was one of the most important strikes of World War I and defied AFL President Sam Gompers, who had made a no-strike pact with President Woodrow Wilson for the duration of the war. But Bill was also interested in public transportation, being a KCATA bus driver. So he told us the story of the three streetcar strikes of that era. Streetcars were vital to the life of Kansas City, and when they shut down, so did the city. In preparation for that presentation and to figure out where our tour bus would go, Bill and I once again went looking for the old streetcar barn, which was supposed to be at 9th and Brighton. Alas, KC failed again to preserve its history. Nothing was there. The bus stopped there anyway, and Bill told the inspiring story of the three strikes and the awesome solidarity and militance of KC labor in the general strike, which was called in support of women laundry workers, many of whom were black. Bill knew how to tell a story and do the research to back it up. He always put things in context of the class struggle, the rule or misrule of political and labor leaders, and he kept the faith that given a chance, working people could solve their own problems.
Thank you, Judy. Next, Bill was president of his UE local, United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers Union in Minneapolis. and he was also an organizer with the UE. Ed Bruno, UE Director of Organization and Labor Party National Organizer, will share that part of Bill's life with us.
Thank you for asking me to do this. It's an honor to do it, although bittersweet. Bill's a good guy to tell stories about, and I have a couple from his UE years, which I think will give people a sense of the kind of rank and file labor leader he was. When I first met Bill, it was in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and he handed me a fly swatter. I should go to the beginning of this story and tell you that the way this came about. So they were closing, Litton Microwave were closing their plant in Minneapolis, and Bill was the president, as Tony said, and he'd volunteer to help organize and bring the union to South Dakota. The UE national offices at that time asked me if I'd go up and join Bill in this effort, so I drove up from Carolina, and there I was in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, which turned out to be a lot like the American South. So UE has a pretty well-deserved reputation for being tight-fisted with dues money. And so I found out that the union had rented a string of rooms in a fairly faded motel, would be a generous way of putting this. And Bill's room adjoined the room that we were using as the organizing headquarters. And because it was the organizing headquarters, it was very busy, and people were in and out. And it happened that we were just down the street from the giant Morrell slaughterhouse stockyard, and there was an awful lot of flies. It became standard operating procedure for all of our UE meetings that when people came in the door, Bill handed everybody a fly swatter. And that was the beginning of our relationship. So one of the very nice things about this organizing driver, and had to do a great deal with Bill, is the UE tends to like to organize in the old school form of organizing, which is to build the union first and later on have a labor board election to prove that the union exists. And this means that you have to have what we used to call a great deal of shop struggle in the plant over issues of concern to the workers and making demands to the bosses to bargain remedies that are satisfactory to the workers. This was like music to Bill's ears. And his background in Minneapolis was suited for this. And he became somewhat like the conductor of an orchestra. And at any given day in the life of this Litton plant, countless department committees would be approaching their bosses with issues of concern to them, saying, we want to negotiate a remedy, and we have a couple of ideas of what the remedy should be. And Bill presided over this chaotic situation. It was a big plant. I think about 1,000 people in the plant. And every department was encouraged to frame their own demands and have their own issues and figure out their own remedies. And the key thing, of course, is to turn individual grievances into group grievances, so that we're talking about not solving individual people's problems, but solving problems collectively, hopefully to leading to a contract, so that we had such a degree of confusion that we had to color code all the flyers so that we knew what department was supposed to get what flyers. So this one got yellow, this one got red, this one got pink. And Bill devised this method that he called commando sheets. A commando sheet wasn't a full page. It was sometimes a quarter page, sometimes even just a quarter page of paper that updated people, gave them a quick update on where do we stand on this issue, where do we stand on that issue, or it might call people to a meeting, come to meet in front of the foreman's office. We're going to go in and discuss vacation policy and so forth and so on. So this was going on every day, day in, day out, every day, day in, day out throughout this plant. And Bill was the conductor of a discordant orchestra. We backed this up with committee members getting up during lunchtime in the cafeteria and giving impromptu speeches about the progress they were making on resolving their issues and what they look forward to do in contract negotiations. So it was quite a show. And that was Bill's role in this organizing. As we approached the labor board election day, because you do have to have an election, Bill became a radio producer. And we devised this program. You know, a lot of funny things happen in factories all the time. And when unions are pressing on the management tends to do both funny and stupid things all at the same time. So Bill produced a series of radio shows that we put on the radio during drive time, shift change, that we called Litton Workers Joke About Their Union. And they would talk about all the funny things they made the boss do on that day and what they hoped to do with their union. It goes without saying, I suppose, that the union won the election and went on to negotiate a contract. Years later, I met Bill in Kansas City, both of us doing work in Labor Party, and his wife. And they invited me to stay overnight. I was on a little speaking tour on behalf of the Labor Party's Workers' Rights Campaign. And I stayed overnight at Bill's house. And he told me after the meeting, we had a couple of beers, he said, I'd like to tell you about my grandmother. And I said, okay. He said, she was a German-American immigrant, and she spoke both German and English. And during World War I, some parts of the country forbid the use of the German language in public. And he says, you know what? My grandmother from that day forward never spoke a word of English in public again. And I suspect Bill would like to be remembered that way, as a somebody with a really bad attitude and a willful contrariness, which, you know, is really necessary attributes for a good union leader. So thank you for asking me to come on. It just reminded me of stories I haven't thought about in decades.
Thank you. You reminded me of stories that I heard, too, that I had forgotten about. Thank you. Next is Bill and the Labor Party, which he helped lead and organize in Kansas City and on the national level, where he worked with Mark Dudzik, who is the former national organizer of the Labor Party and currently organizer, I hope I have that right, of the labor campaign for single-payer health care. Mark?
Hey, thanks, Tony. And thanks, Heartland Labor Forum, for doing this. One of the miseries of this damn pandemic is that we can't get together and reminisce and honor someone of the magnitude of Bill, who touched so many lives. And it's good to be able to speak and with Mary as partner and wife and his good friends and comrades. So I'm glad to be here. I think anybody who spent more than 5 minutes with Bill will realize that he believed in his very bones that workers in the United States needed a party of their own, a workers' party. And I think, you know, we just heard about some of his trade union experiences. And I think, you know, he kind of came into the labor movement at a time when the process of capitalist globalization was really intensifying. And he was, you know, right on the cutting edge, particularly with the Litton and UE experiences. And then, you know, the multi-year struggles with the Amalgamated Transit Union in Kansas City. And these certainly were sort of underpinning, you know, the reasons why Bill could gravitated towards a vision of workers' independent politics. So when my good friend Tony Mazzocchi, who came out of my union, the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers, launched a group called Labor Party Advocates in 1992, Bill was a charter member. He signed on immediately. Bill attended the founding convention of the Labor Party in 1996, which remains one of the most inspirational political experiences of my life as a trade unionist and a worker activist. And he was a fixture at all of our national and regional Labor Party events. He certainly was the heart and the soul of the Kansas City Labor Party chapter, one of the most vibrant and least riven by sectarian division chapters in the country. And I see my good friend Ed Bruno shaking his head on that. And he was elected to represent all of the Midwestern Labor Party chapters on our national council, where he played a crucial role throughout the years of the Labor Party. In 2006, he made it a point to travel to Columbia, South Carolina, to celebrate the certification of the South Carolina Labor Party as the first state Labor Party with electoral certification in the United States. And while he was there, he also made it a point to indulge his other passion, which is for exploring local barbecue joints and getting the most out of that. And he dragged me. He had somehow researched like five or six different barbecue joints in the Columbia, South Carolina area, and made sure that he dragged us to as many as he could while he was there. So as the labor movement began to turn back inward in the 2000s and support for the Labor Party diminished, you know, Bill still kept the Kansas City chapter alive much longer than many of the other local and regional organizations of the Labor Party. He did that because of his personal vision and the very force of his will around these issues. Now, we had a lot of sharp debates in the Labor Party, and I didn't always agree with Bill, but he always projected this sense of civility and just plain old common sense when we had these debates. And he provided a living example of how a real kind of a workers' movement built on mutual respect could really build unity around what we had in common and agree to disagree around what we didn't have in common. I can recall two examples where Bill's moral vision really made a difference in the work that we and a number of union activists did during this period. You know, first of all, in 2002 and 2003, when the Bush administration was orchestrating the invasion of Iraq with massive buy-in from both political parties and the whole basic mainstream media establishment, Bill was adamant that a workers' party must take a strong stand against this march to war. And his moral passion emboldened many of us who, you know, this is post 2000, 9/11, 2001, when, you know, a lot of us were hiding. He emboldened many of us to speak out and take a stand. And his efforts also helped launch the U.S. Labor Against the War movement, which resulted in, for the first time in history, the national labor movement taking a stand against the war while our troops were deployed overseas. And Bill was a large part of that. The other thing that Bill was really prescient on was how global warming was going to impact the lives of working people. And he demanded that we move forward with a focus on just transition and really address that issue. And, you know, this was 20 years before the Green New Deal, and many of the things that he said and did 20 years ago are now embodied in the principles of the Green New Deal. So I think about Bill often whenever I see the likes of Joe Manchin block the most minor legislation that would improve the lives of working people. You know, I think that, you know, he would say something like, you know, there's always going to be a Joe Manchin, Bill would say. You know, until we have a party of our own, we're always fighting with one hand tied behind our back. The creation of the party of labor is the great unfinished task of the U.S. working class. So rest in power, Brother Bill, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I still have my laminated card from the founding convention. Thank you. Proudly, I carry it. Next, we will talk about what we said earlier. Bill's life was a lifelong commitment to the Marxist movement. Adam Schills, a longtime activist of the Marxist movement, retired teacher, and longtime friend of Bill, will tell us about the Marxist impact upon Bill and Bill's impact upon the Marxist movement. Adam?
Thank you very much, Tony, and thank the organizers of this meeting. It's an honor to be on the platform with such other labor movement figures tonight. You know, Bill's introduction to socialism and class struggle was not a successful one at all. In the 1956 or 60 election, Bill saw on television a speaker for the Socialist Labour Party. So Bill wrote to that party and to all the left-wing parties he knew of. Only one of them, the Socialist Labour Party, had a member in Kansas City at that time. And an old gentleman who hadn't had anyone express interest for a long time was overjoyed that a young boy had contacted his party, so made his way out to Bill's house and rang the front doorbell. However, Mrs. O'Nash, Bill's mother, was going to have none of it, of a strange man entering her teenage son's room and talking in private to them. This was before Stranger Danger, but the O'Nash family personality has already been referred to in our broadcast this evening. So this created a great argument with Bill and with his mother. And in the end, a compromise was reached whereby the old comrade, the old gentleman, was able to explain socialist industrial unionism to the teenage Bill through a locked screen door with a glowering Mrs. O'Nash, probably with a rolling pin, I suspect, in her hand, standing there. I want tonight to ask just one question. Why did Bill do all the things that he did? What was he hoping to achieve? What motivated Bill was a Marxist view of the class struggle. This led Bill to four conclusions. One, as a Marxist, Bill believed that capitalist society was based on the exploitation of the working class. This meant that there was a fundamental conflict between the working class and the employers, no community of interest between the two, that the conflict between the two was a fundamental feature of our world and would continue until labor had won and capital had been defeated. Bill knew that one had to act on one's belief. One had to do something about it in the real world. Obviously, if you believed that the working class movement, the labor movement, was the force that could change the world, you had to take your own place in the movement. This led to Bill's work in two of the four main activist projects of his life. That was his work in the ATU that Javier spoke so well about, and his work in the UE that our old friend Ed Bruno just spoke about. Bill believed that the working class should extend the fight from the workplace to politics as working class and into working class independence. This led to his commitment and role in the Labour Party that Mark just spoke about. This then was the fundamental driving force of Bill's life, a world outlook of class struggle and a commitment to personally participating in that struggle through the organized labor movement. Two, as a Marxist, Bill opposed the foreign policy of the employers, imperialism as he saw it. And this led to his fourth sustained bout of movement activity, the anti-Vietnam War movement, where he was quite active in Minneapolis and throughout the Midwest. When I first met him in the early 80s, Bill would wear on his UE jacket a button, "Labor solidarity has no borders." That was a more modern, more lively way of saying workers of the world unite. Thirdly, as a Marxist, Bill believed that the working class movement should have a definite goal, socialism, a society based on workers' control and power. So Bill was always active in the building of the socialist movement, not in a loud, dramatic way, but in a steady way. finally, Bill as a Marxist believed that the working class needed its own intellectuals. So Bill read and studied widely. He spoke on topics such as armed struggle in Latin America, economic change in the Soviet Union, to the climate crisis. But probably his greatest contribution was his writing on the U.S. labor movement. This writing, in a style that people could enjoy, showed a profound unraveling of the trends in our society. To conclude, Bill did all these things humbly. He saw himself as one man in a large army, but he was mistaken there. He wasn't one man in a large army. He was a very important captain in a large army. Thank you very much, Tony. I'm sure I joined the other speakers in sending Mary our best. Thank you and have a good evening.
Thank you. Thank you. In the couple of minutes we have left, it's actually time for some personal sidebars and tributes from his wife, Mary Ario, Jeff Hensfeld, and myself. Mary?
Hi. First, I want to thank everyone for sharing your memories about Bill. I actually learned a lot. So many good memories have been rushing back to me in the past half hour, but I will focus on a few. When Bill was not busy with the Labor Party, his union activities, organizing conferences, or writing, he was a number one fan of the Kansas City Royals. In fact, our first date was the Royals' home opener in 1997. The Royals beat the Orioles, which was a good sign for us. We spent many happy hours watching and arguing about the good and bad of baseball. Bill loved to travel. Maybe it was because his parents took him on annual car trips as a child. A long journey around Lake Superior was our first trip together, and we survived it. I think his favorite spot was an old-time storefront bookstore in the Upper Peninsula. Even as his health was failing, he wanted to experience London a second time after many years. In London, we were in the middle of the climate strike demonstration, as well as a Karl Marx tour, which he greatly enjoyed, and I'm glad for that. I believe it is important for Bill's ideas and writings to be available to everyone for a very long time. Bill's passion for the last 20 years of his life was his website, kclabor.org, including his Week in Review. His writings from kclabor.org, local conference speeches, and other insightful articles that I can gather will be passed on to the Eastside Freedom Library at esfl.org in St. Paul, Minnesota, where his personal library was also donated. To me, Bill is unforgettable. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Mary. Jeff, we're closing in on a minute and a half left of our time. So
I got to know Bill on a personal level, one-on-one, and in small groups around the dining room table in the house that he and Mary shared. The discussions ranged widely, and they were as many disagreements as agreements, but none with rancor. The one issue that really was very important to Bill that has not been touched on enough tonight is his concern for the environment and belief that the climate crisis and class struggle were inextricably entwined. That is reflected in his writings on KC Labor website and his coverage of climate change actions around the world in his weekly reports. His concern for the environment and a bit of nostalgia coupled with the desire to express his beliefs with action, led Bill to buy an old-fashioned push mower. Many of us of a certain age made this mistake, thinking that we could better the planet and our own condition with this kind of exercise. Unfortunately, we found it very difficult to mow ourselves into shape, but rather that we must be in shape to mow this way, and that yards with dips and divots, hills and terraces, are a difficult row to mow. Bill at times was a bit crusty, maybe a bit dogmatic, but that exterior has always tempered by his love for the working class. He will be missed by many people and a whole lot of feral cats.
And with that, we want to say to everyone, thank you for listening. And it's been a pleasure for me to go down and honor Bill. Thank you all.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right.
Good evening, and welcome to another edition of Know Your Rights. I'm Mike Amash with the law firm of Blake & Euling. This month on Know Your Rights, we're going to discuss two items that we've heard a lot about recently as it relates to COVID-19 and vaccine mandates. The first is how religious exemptions apply to such requirements, and the second is how HIPAA applies, or actually doesn't apply, to vaccine mandates in the workplace. Federal law permits an employer to require all employees entering the workplace be vaccinated. However, other laws, namely Title VII and the ADA, may require an employer provide reasonable accommodations for employees who are unable to get vaccinated due to a disability or due to sincerely held religious belief. In order to obtain a religious exemption from a vaccine requirement, the individual must demonstrate that the belief or practice is both religious, of course, and that it is sincerely held. The element of sincerity is fundamental since, in the words of one court, if the religious beliefs that apparently prompted a request are not sincerely held, there has been no showing of a religious observance or practice that conflicts with an employment requirement. The EEOC has advised that if an employer has an objective basis for questioning either the religious nature or the sincerity of a particular belief, the employer would be justified in seeking additional supporting information from the individual. An individual who fails to cooperate with a reasonable request for verification of the sincerity or religious nature of a professed belief risks losing any subsequent claim that he or she was improperly denied an accommodation. Now let's talk about the word accommodation. Because if somebody does obtain a religious exemption, Title VII would require that an employer provide a reasonable accommodation for the employee who, because of the sincerely held religious belief, does not get vaccinated, unless providing such an accommodation would pose an undue hardship on the employer's business. Examples of a reasonable accommodation for vaccination could include unvaccinated employees wear face masks, work at a social distance from coworkers, work a modified shift, test periodically for COVID-19, and provide the opportunity to telework or accept a reassignment. Courts have been wrestling with religious exemptions to vaccine requirements for years. For example, in 2018, a Minnesota court ruled that the plaintiff who was seeking an exemption was driven by personal secular belief and not religious belief, where she was unable to provide any evidence supporting a connection between the practice of her religion and abstinence from the influenza vaccination, and was unable to cite to any specific Bible verses to support her personal belief. In 2016, a New York court ruled where a plaintiff opposed vaccine because they ruled against a plaintiff where they opposed a vaccine because they arguably contained monkey cells, pork derivatives, and aborted human fetuses, the court noting there that the plaintiff had not demonstrated that his opposition stemmed from religious rather than simply moral beliefs. Now let's transition over to a brief discussion about HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. The HIPAA privacy rule establishes standards to protect individuals' medical records and other personal health information. Significant to the discussion of HIPAA as it relates to the current controversies surrounding vaccines is who is covered and who is not. HIPAA applies to covered entities. A covered entity is a health plan, a healthcare clearinghouse, or a healthcare provider. Under HIPAA, protected health information, or PHI, is considered to be any identifiable health information that is used, maintained, stored, or transmitted by a HIPAA-covered entity, again a healthcare provider, a health plan, or health insurance clearinghouse, as it relates to the provisions of healthcare or payment for healthcare services. So two important facts. The privacy rule applies to covered entities. And the privacy rule regulates how and when covered entities are permitted to use and disclose protected health information. The privacy rule does not apply when an individual is asked about their vaccination status by a school, an employer, a store, a restaurant, an entertainment venue, or another individual. There's a lot of information out there about HIPAA as it relates to the COVID-19 vaccine and about religious exemptions. But just remember, just because it was put on Twitter, even if it was put on Twitter by a congressperson, doesn't make it true.
And that's it for our show tonight. The calendar is on our Facebook page. If you want to find out about upcoming events, go to the Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. The show is called Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America, and Unchecked Mergers with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to tonight's heroic engineer, Chad Brothers. And stay tuned for the Thursday night special. It's Stand Up, produced by the Racial Justice Initiative.
Disgrace and standing side by side with working people, sweating for an honest wage I'll never be ashamed of. So take it in stride, we've still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class and that's the place to be.
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
To struggle and fight for the common man's rights to be in the world.